Welcome to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guest is Dr. Shelley Garoni. Garoni is a doctor of medicine in internal and palliative medicine, and since 1999 has been with Kaiser Permanente in Sacramento and Roseville. During her tenure as a general hospital internist, she created the existing palliative care department. Most of Garoni's patients tell her that the prospect of being sick and the process of dying is much more frightening than the thought of being dead. In this hour, she talks about what happens to human bodies nearing death and whether there are things we can know in terms of meeting our loved ones' needs and preventing suffering. And now, join Dr. Shelley Garoni on stage at the JCCSF.
So thank you so much for coming. I'm honored to be here. So a little bit about me. You heard that I did some palliative medicine training. And so I went through med school, and I realized pretty early on in my med school career that death and dying is something that I find fascinating. And so you could argue about what's wrong with me to say that I find that fascinating, and maybe I need my own mental health examination. But I was a third-year med student, and I had a patient. I was on the neurology service. I had a patient who had come in with a stroke. And if you had to have a stroke, hers was the best kind to have. It was in the base of her brain, so she could think, she could talk, she could have her own personality. She just was clumsy as all hell and couldn't walk. And I thought, well, shoot, you know, if you got to have a stroke, this is an okay way, until her brain got so swollen that she became brain dead. And that next day, I was watching my attending, and I was watching the senior residents, and they were so clinical and so callous and so cold about determining this lady's brain death. And the way you determine the brain death is you turn off life support and you watch what happens. And so I was watching the monitor, and for the 5 minutes that life support was off, nothing changed on that monitor. Her heart rate clicked right along, her blood pressure clicked right along, her oxygen levels clicked right along. Nothing changed except that she didn't breathe. And so when we turned the machines back on and we did the blood tests to confirm that she had not breathed and therefore had all of these mismatches of oxygen and carbon dioxide, and we told her family that confirms that her brain is dead, they said their goodbyes, and they were going to try and leave the ICU so that we could turn the machines off for good. And I remember watching the resident not wanting them to leave, like he was afraid to be alone with this woman who was dying. And the family was anxious because they really didn't want to be there. And I could completely appreciate that. And so I looked at them and I said, you know, it's okay. You don't have to stay. I'm here. I know her. I'll stay. I'll hold her hand. It's all right. And the poor resident was looking at me like, you're strange. And what's wrong with you? And the family left and we turned off the machines. And within seconds, heart rate fell, blood pressure fell, oxygen levels fell. Within seconds. She had held all of that for 5 minutes prior. And as those numbers were falling, I'm staring at the monitor, and I got that weird feeling that someone's watching you. And it was her. I could feel somehow her watching me. And there was this presence up over here somewhere, watching that body and watching me, because I was holding her hand, telling her, it's okay, you can go. And so now I'm starting to sob, right? Because that's what happens when spirit touches you, or at least when it touches me, I cry. So I start to sob, and my fellow classmates and the resident are looking at me like, you are so weird. And are you sure you're in the right job? Because we're thinking you're not in the right job. And, you know, you're a third-year med student. What the hell do you know? And honestly, as soon as that monitor flatlined, that presence went away. And I remember looking at the monitor thinking, wow, that's crazy. How did that work? And why did I feel her? And maybe I'm just making this all up. But it made me curious. It piqued my curiosity. Like, there's so much to this that I don't understand. And I think that the universe pulls us into situations where we need to learn or where we can truly be helpful. And so I've been involved a lot now through my career. I didn't really know what palliative care was until I was in fellowship. And I was going to do critical care. That's what I actually went to fellowship to do, because I really love being around super sick people. And if they live or they die, I've decided that that's a problem of the universe and a plan that I'm not necessarily calling the shots of, but I can try and ease transition either way. So this Dilbert cartoon about the Grim Reaper coming to visit Dilbert, and Dilbert looking at the Grim Reaper saying, "You don't look so grim." And the Grim Reaper saying, "Well, unlike you, I actually really love my job." I do really love my job. And it's funny, because if you take me to cocktail parties or you let strangers meet me and they figure out my day job, 2 out of 3 will back away from me. It's almost like they think I can zap them or something, or I'm creepy. Or so I'm trying to encourage you, don't think I'm creepy, and I'm willing to answer any question, because I did learn really early on that we doctors are not trained. And I think that that's the saddest thing for me in 20 years of a career, is we doctors are not trained. So you come to us with somebody in your family who is terribly sick, and you might find that we're callous or we're cold. Sometimes we come across as rude, and I will tell you that all physicians, in my experience, are type A people. We like to be respected. We ideally like to be right and liked. We sleep deprived for a decade. We don't handle conflict well, and you hope that we're going to be able to talk you through the dying of your loved one. We struggle with that. We very much struggle with that. And so I'll ask you to cut the physicians a tiny break. You don't have to give us a big one, but a tiny break, and then really understand where we come from, because we aren't well trained. So I'm going to start a story about two gentlemen, and then I won't tell you the end of the story till we get to the end of the hour. It's just a teaser. Our first gentleman is Bill. Bill is 86 years old. He's in my ICU with Parkinson's disease. He has aspiration pneumonia, which has caused complete system failure. And he really is not getting better. We've given him everything we know how to do, and he's not getting better. Family has recognized that he's dying, but they want him to know that he's dying, and they're afraid to tell him. We contrast Bill with Joe. Joe is a little bit younger. He's 68, but God bless the man, he had the misfortune of 2 cancers at the same time. So this was not one cancer that had metastasized. It was 2 different cancers. One of them did metastasize, I don't know which one of them, and had gone to his spine and made him paraplegic during my hospitalization when I was the doctor caring for him. And the family, he had this gigantic family, and the family was so in tune with hope, and I couldn't say anything to take away his hope. And so even though we had some very real nasty badness going down for this poor man, they didn't really want to talk about it in front of him because of that fear of taking away his hope. So today we're going to talk about the D word. It's an uncomfortable word. Death and dying is not something that normal humans think about. And it's one of those things where we probably should think about it. My husband's aunt lived to be 100 years old, and I will tell you, she never wanted to think about dying because it was just not in her realm. She had this tremendous fear of missing out, and for her, dying was going to aggravate all of her FOMO. And so even as she was pushing 90, 95, 97, 98, 99, and you'd say, "Dang it, Aunt Mary, I think you've kind of officially crossed the line of old." No, hundred's coming and I can go longer. She tried, God bless her, but I think 100 actually was her goal. She died a month after her 100th birthday. And I will suggest to you that I think there is more to us than just our bodies. I don't have any science to back me up on this. I can't kill people and bring them back and ask them if they saw a light or if they experienced things. You can't get those things through clinical trial. I've just watched a lot of people die. And so I will share with you some of my experiences and leave it to you to decide what feels right for you. I have learned in my career that what feels right to my patients and their families often is what's right. We're going to question if love dies, and then we're going to talk about a little bit of gentleness. I'm going to ask you to do a thought experiment with me. I'm going to ask you to assume that you are incredibly old. You are decades away from now. You can be as old as you want. 120 is fine. I don't care. I'm asking you to assume that not only are you incredibly old, everything you came to the planet to accomplish, everything you've worried about through your life, you have accomplished. So maybe you were trying to get to be the next president, or you were trying to get your grandchildren off payroll, or at least your children off payroll. That has not happened in my house yet. Or maybe you are working towards getting world peace, or you've solved world hunger. I don't care. Whatever you have come to the planet to accomplish, you have accomplished. Everything that you came to worry about, you no longer worry about. There's no more arguments with your spouse about the level of the television. You don't really care what each other is watching. You have lived a full and complete life. It is okay for you to think about letting go of this body and transitioning to whatever comes after death. So that's the scenario that we're working in. You're old, you've lived everything you needed to live, everything that you've wanted to accomplish, and it's okay to think about dying. So as you think about that, I am going to ask you, where would you like to be when you take your last breath? And I'd ask you to just shout it out, please. Where would you like to be at the time of your death? Home. Where else? Hospital? By the ocean. There's another by the ocean. And just really upset the Safeway staff. I like that. They get a little freaky when they have to do the paperwork. But, you know, you're not there to worry about it. So you're going for Safeway's the first time I've heard that. That's awesome. Any other takers? I've got hospital, home, ocean, and Safeway. The forest, somewhere in nature. So I will tell you, most people, Safeway is the first time I've heard Safeway, most people say they want to die at home. When we poll Californians, 90% of Californians say they actually would prefer to die at home. And home probably is that choice of nature as well, right? So by the ocean, in the forest. I'm going to give Safeway as home too. So most people choose to not be institutionalized. But when you look at the current statistics in California, the vast majority of Californians are institutionalized at the time of death. So 25% get to die at home. The rest are hospitals or board and cares or assisted living or skilled nursing facility level care. And what really saddens me about this is if we were honest and we, healthcare, started talking with our patients and families about dying and really what to expect and reasonable care choices, we could get people home. I actually can make home pretty easy in terms of a plan and being able to facilitate it. When I have my inpatients decide to go home, I can usually have them home the next day with a full small hospital in their home. So I can get a bed and medications and I can get people really pretty darn quick. But because we are so death adverse in our culture and we don't want to talk about these things, oftentimes it's the very last hour that we finally say, oh, well, and then it's too late. So death has to occur institutionalized. So now let's go to the second part of the question. The premise is the same. You're very old. You've accomplished everything that you need to accomplish. It's okay to think about dying, which we understand is not today, but this is decades away. And some of you started touching on it. If you could choose your mode of death, what would the diagnosis be? What goes on your death certificate? So I heard falling over at Safeway. Any other? What would be your cause of death? Natural causes. Are you thinking that you just wake up dead one day? We had a friend who dropped over on his way to Mass and had a sudden cardiac arrest in his house. I'm pretty sure that when he walked into heaven instead of his church, he didn't really know what he was doing. I just kept thinking about him, like, well, I wonder how that felt for him, right? But this idea of sudden death, I am who I am. I have all my function. So I can choose between artichokes and broccoli. I can think. I can be who I am. I personally am very uptight of about my own activities of daily living, specifically wiping my own tushy. I don't want people doing that for me. I want to be able to have my own power to take care of this physical frame. And so those that die suddenly have that, right? They've had everything that they were used to doing. And then they just either didn't wake up, they died of natural causes, they fall over dead in a store somewhere. My husband has a terrible joke about wanting to die in his sleep like Grandpa, not like the other three in the car who are kicking and screaming. But that kind of thing, right? I am who I am, and then suddenly I'm not like that anymore. Now on the slide, you see a percentage, 10 to 15% of Americans. Any idea what that means? That's the number of Americans who actually die suddenly. So sudden death is big news, right? It's dramatic. It makes the presses. We hear about it. I'm from Sacramento, and so that 99 corridor, Stockton and Fresno, we hear lots about gunshots and violence and that kind of sudden death, which is just so hard to deal with on any given day. And survivors of folks who die suddenly will tell you that the hardest thing for them is not being able to say goodbye. Or remembering that the last thing I said was I growled at him as he walked out the door, or I didn't say I love you, or I didn't say thank you for something. So survivors, I think, have a much harder time with sudden death as opposed to those who were dying. All right, so 10 to 15% of Americans, three of you spoke up, you get to die suddenly. Bing! The rest of you have to choose something else, so I'm going to ask if I have any takers for a death from cancer. Couple? A couple, yeah. And I would take cancer. And I'll tell you why I like cancer. Cancer, again, I have all my function. I am who I am. When I start to lose function and I can no longer manage this body's activities of daily living, death is pretty fast thereafter. So I took care of one of my nurses years and years ago who died of a melanoma. She lived alone until 36 hours before her death. And the only reason she had help come in at the 36th hour is she couldn't walk anymore. And that was the only reason. Otherwise, she would have lived alone all the way to her death. So I like that. I like being able to have control of my body, tell my family, you know what, I'm going to give you a few days to get used to the idea that I'm checking out, and then I'm going to check out. I don't think I want to be fighting to stay in a body that's sick. Now, what my families tell me is that this is really very hard because, again, in healthcare, we are not terribly honest about what happens to a cancer patient. And what I describe to my patients is cancer is a vacuum. It keeps sucking energy. Even when we're really fighting hard against the disease and they're looking good, if that cancer's still in there and it's active, it's sucking energy. And as the energy begins to dwindle and then finally really decrease and wane a lot, there becomes a critical mass, at which point the body just can't overcome. And so family members of somebody who's dying of cancer will look at me and say, but we just went on a trip a month ago. She was just shopping 2 weeks ago. What do you mean she's dying now? How did this happen? Did you miss something? Did you do something wrong? And so it's a lot of conversation around this suck of energy that cancer causes. There are 20 to 25% of Americans today dying of cancer. The other thing that's making cancer a little bit weird is we're finding all of these new targeted therapies. So diagnoses that used to be uniformly fatal, like sarcoma or ovarian cancer, were able to give targeted therapies, and people are living years and actually living relatively well. So it has changed the landscape, and I think for my oncologists, they probably struggle almost more than their patients, because they all have somebody on their panel who did incredibly well with salvage therapy. And then there's everybody knows somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody that beat the odds. My grandmother died at 88 years of COPD. That was 18 years after her pancreatic cancer was cut out of her body. So when she got diagnosed with pancreatic cancer and she went to surgery, and the surgeon came out of the OR and told my family, well, it could be 5 weeks, 5 months, or 5 years, I personally was furious. I was like, how the hell are you giving a year's prognosis? This is pancreatic cancer. People are dead within a year uniformly. And grandma got radiation therapy. She got no chemotherapy, but she says she was a stubborn Swede. If there's a God, I think she gave God the finger, frankly, and said, I'm not going. Honestly, right? So she pulled 18 years after that surgery. And my oncologists will tell me that they're gamblers, all of them. That they roll the dice and they are just this consummate person of hope that this patient is going to be the one that has that tremendous response. Okay, we're going to continue our thought experiment. So we've got four of us going with cancer, three of you going suddenly. The rest of you still have to choose a cause of death on your death certificate. Do I have any takers for organ failure? Heart failure, COPD, liver failure? Got one. One brave soul. Two. All right, you've got a friend. Organ failure, I think, is difficult to live with. Organ failure is one of those conditions. And again, it can be lung failure, COPD or pulmonary fibrosis, heart failure, liver failure, kidney failure. Some would argue skin failure. My mother has skin failure right now, and it is acting like organ failure. But the challenge with organ failure is I am who I am, and then I get an exacerbation. So if I'm living with emphysema, maybe I get pneumonia. or I'm living with heart failure. I had a patient years ago who came into my hospital every 4 weeks, and she came in because she went out for teriyaki chicken every fourth week, and then she'd throw herself into a heart failure exacerbation and get admitted to my hospital. So when I get into an exacerbation living with organ failure, I can't do anything. Functionally, I'm as weak as a kitten. I can't walk. I can't dress myself. I may not be able to feed myself. I feel terrible. I look terrible. Now, I will get better because hospitalists are good docs. The ICU docs are good docs. Heart failure specialists, pulmonary specialists, they're good doctors. They can get me better. But what you'll notice in that sawtooth pattern is I'm never back to baseline. I'm always changing. I'm always declining. And in between my exacerbations, I'm getting sicker, but it's so subtle, it's like watching your hair grow.
You're listening to Dr. Shelley Garoni, specialist in hospice and palliative care for Kaiser Permanente, speaking on what happens to human bodies nearing death and whether there are things we can know in terms of preventing such suffering. On Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So I mentioned Grandma died of COPD, that's emphysema. Grandma used to play 18 holes of golf walking. 5 years before her death, she started driving. 4 years before her death, she drove 9 holes. 3 years before her death, she went to the driving range. 2 years before her death, she claimed that the golf course planted new plants to which she was allergic. Right? She was great. This was the same woman that said she needed to keep smoking because it forced her to cough. Anyway, whatever. So organ failure is hard to live with, right? Because I'm losing function imperceptibly over time. And I only notice it when I start looking back at chunks of time. So when I'm admitting an organ failure patient or talking with an organ failure patient or their family, my question is, what were you like this time last year? And when we talk about what were you like this time last year, all of a sudden it's clear. They can see, I'm so much different now, right? Because by the time I'm getting called in, things have gone really pretty bad. And the other thing that you'll notice on that sawtooth pattern is that the exacerbations become more frequent as we get closer toward the end of life. They get harder, and I never recover ever, right? So the other thing that I hear from my families is, he was discharged too early from the hospital. Well, you've got to rehab him to get him back like he was. I can't, right? And there is no such thing as a too early discharge in an organ failure patient. There's a window of opportunity where I can get you well enough to be home. And if you stay in my hospital too much longer, you're going to acquire some infection from my hospital. And this makes it really difficult on families because, again, the last exacerbation looks just like the one before it. So when I'm listening to family members say, well, he was on the ventilator last month and he did fine. What do you mean where he's dying now? That just doesn't compute with me. So we draw these pictures so that they can actually see what's been happening. And that helps sometimes to be able to cope with the loss. So let me finish up one last disease trajectory for you. We've got 3 people dying suddenly, 4 of us going of cancer, 2 brave souls going with organ failure. The rest of you have not made a decision yet, so I'm going to make it for you. You're dying demented and frail. Sorry, want to change your mind now? So dementia and frailty, to me, are the same disease. They really are not. They're different. The frail person keeps all of her marbles. The demented person loses them. But the body is doing the same thing in both disease trajectories. So the demented body is actually a physiological disease. We think of dementia, something like Alzheimer's or vascular dementia or Parkinson's disease with dementia. We think of dementia as a cognitive disorder. I'm just forgetting who you are or forgetting events that we did or forgetting that I just asked you this same question 3 times or forgetting that I just ate breakfast. But in fact, dementia is a disease of body. Not only is the brain losing cognition, it's losing the ability to feel and control this body. So the demented brain forgets where the feet are. Hence, walking becomes a problem. The demented brain forgets center of balance and center of gravity, so sitting ultimately becomes a problem. The demented brain forgets what a full rectum feels like, and it forgets what a full bladder feels like. Incontinence becomes a problem. So now I've got a body that can fall over and be incontinent on itself. Ultimately, the demented brain forgets how to absorb calories. So even if I force calories into a demented body, it will continue to lose weight. And the brain forgets how to mobilize the immune system. So I start seeing recurrent and repeated infections. And finally, the demented brain forgets how to swallow. So dementia is really a horrible disease to watch. And I tell my families all the time when I'm working with a demented elder that for me it is the most dehumanizing of illnesses to watch. It is the most painful to watch. My father-in-law died at 92, and the poor dude was demented as a doorknob. And it was horrible because he started his dementia at 78. So it was 14 years of watching parts of him die every year. And in the beginning, it was funny. He was a chef. He loved to be in the kitchen making sauce. He was Italian, so everything was red sauce and pasta. And, you know, he'd send you home with frozen sauce, and it would say meat sauce, and you'd open it, and vegetables came out. And he'd send home vegetarian sauce, and the ribs would fall out of it. You know, so he just, in the beginning, you could laugh and joke about it, and even he could joke about it. His wife would get on his case about forgetting something, and he'd look at her and shrug his shoulders and say, short-term memory loss, you know, but then you start losing personality. And that's hard. That's hard to watch. And I think it was super hard on the family to watch him. And he was a very smart man. He was a social man. So he would pick up on social cues. He had 7 grandchildren, and one of them would run through the house and say, "Hey, Grandpa." He'd look at the gender of the person running, and he would say, "Hey, grandson." Right, he had no idea who this person actually was, but had enough social grace that he could continue to interact a little bit. And that's what I think the other thing that makes dementia hard on families, and I hear that quite often. Well, she's still talking. Well, she still knows me. Well, those oldest memories are going to be the last to go, right? So my father-in-law never lost his children. Actually, I do think he started seeing his daughter as his wife, but he never forgot who his sons were. Those of us who came into the picture much later in his life course, yeah, I was just a drill sergeant and he didn't care for my regime. But you just have to learn to allow people to be where they are, right? And what I teach my families is that the demented elder, that vibrant spirit who was that person before dementia, is still in there, right? They're just trapped in a brain that's beginning to scramble. I love this quote from Isaac Asimov, right? You know, life is pleasant, death is peaceful, the transition becomes the problem. And I will ask patients if they can engage in this conversation with me, are you afraid of being dead or afraid of getting to dead? Because those are two different things, right? I've had some patients who are so afraid of being dead, my mother. My mother is living with skin failure right now. I expect her death coming in the next year or so. She's terrified of being dead. And I can't tell how much it is terror of being dead and terror of missing out. I think they're both at play. But because she's so afraid, she won't talk, which means she won't let my brother and I know what she's thinking and what she's hoping for. She's another one that we could make plans and we could have things go, but she won't talk to us about what she's wishing. We're going to talk a little bit about what normal dying looks like. I feel a little weird always saying the words normal and dying in the same sentence, but believe it or not, bodies do tend to follow a pretty typical trajectory. If you've ever had an animal that you've had to put down, I have found that animals follow similar trajectory as well. And it's been interesting to be in a field of treating humans and talking to veterinary colleagues about this and how animals die compared to how humans die. When California enacted the end-of-life law, my veterinarian looked at me and he said, "Well, how's it going to be for you to write those prescriptions?" And I said, "Oh, it makes me queasy. I'm not going to write them." And he goes, "Well, I don't have that option. I'm forced to put animals down." So it was just this interesting conversation about how do humans and animals interact. So normal dying in the months before the death actually occurs, what you're going to find in the patient who's dying is that they're beginning to withdraw. And sickness does this, right? When we're living with a bad sickness, a scary sickness, or a permanent sickness, things that we used to care about don't matter quite so much anymore. So we find that folks aren't necessarily crabbing at what's getting tweeted, or they're not crabbing at traffic, or whatever they might be going down that they're worried about. Life is getting smaller. Social activities are getting smaller. And I've had some family members that was the thing for their loved one. They were always out to lunch or always out to breakfast. I have a 95-year-old patient that I've been treating for a couple of years now, and she came in to see me because the family was worried. She had stopped going to breakfast with her friends. And when I met her I heard her, I put a stethoscope on her back, I could see why. She's dying. And so we started talking about, is it time for hospice and what does that look like? You might start to see some subtle skinniness and some subtle change in intake, so less in the way of food and drink. And you're going to see some more sleep and increased need for rest. And so if you're watching that, what I ask of you is try to be okay with it. The dying person, when all is said and done, is worried about the caregiver. And the caregiver is trying to keep this person alive, and I need you with me. And what do you mean you're trying to die? And I don't think I'm okay with that. And so we'll find at this stage, when we're starting to see that change of intake, that change of character in terms of one's social outings, that families are fighting. No, you have to eat more. No, you have to come out. No, you have to spend time with the family. No, you've slept too much. And really trying to find some peace with change of appetite, change of activity. I think this is the time, if I can get families to start doing their own internal work, because let's face it, dying is hard work, both for the patient and for the family, to start doing some reconciliation around, I hate this, but what if? What if the doctor's right? What if what I'm feeling comes true? And do I know how to pay the bills? Do I know how to do stuff that my loved one here used to do? In the weeks before death, you're going to notice that sleep is definitely increasing. So now there's much less energy in that body. It can't stay awake nearly as long as it used to, and it will try really hard. I'm dealing with a patient right now that I just put into hospice last week, and his wife called me and she said, you know, he didn't get up until 1 o'clock in the afternoon. But, you know, then today he was looking great after sleeping until 1 o'clock yesterday, but he's only been up 2 hours and I can see that he's just fallen over and he needs to go back to bed. Yes, he does, right? You just need to allow that natural sleep. The body is winding itself down, and it does so during sleep. You can definitely see the decrease in intake now. So there's way less food going in. There's actually now less fluid going in as well. And life begins to feel pretty small. I don't really want to go out anymore. I'm not that interested in visitors. I'm not necessarily wanting to read or watch TV or do the things that I used to do even at home. So not only are my social activities gone, but now the quiet time activities that I used to do, really not that interested anymore. And if you're taking care of somebody like this, really watching that loss of appetite has been the hardest thing. And I think that's what we do as humans, right? From the first breath coming out of the womb, we're placed on breast to suckle. We feed each other as humans. That's how we take care. And so when our loved one refuses to eat, it's really very difficult emotionally to wrap our mind around it's okay to eat in front of them. Yes, it's okay to give them a back rub instead of forcing a meal. It's okay to let them take a nap, right? It's just a very difficult thing to do. And really, we want to make the most of wakeful time. So I'm always warning my patients, your energy is fixed and it is finite. All of us actually have energy that is fixed and finite. When we're not living with a terminal illness and we're not dying, we ignore that fact and try and push ourselves beyond our energy and then wonder why we're so dang tired at the end of the week. But in a dying person, it is very noticeable that energy is fixed and finite. And so I will tell families and patients, if you've got something coming up that you know you want to do, you're going to rest up for 2 or 3 days before that event. Go to the event, spend the energy that you've accrued, and know that you're going to need 2 to 4 days after the event to recover. Just plan on it. Don't try and push yourself when you simply cannot push yourself. And I also ask the caregivers not to fight the intake. Take what you want. Don't worry about the rest. And not to fight themselves, right? That this is really now is being forced into all of us, and we have to begin taking grasp of our own ability to take care of ourselves. In the last days before death occurs, there is mostly sleep, very little wakeful time. And so we might find that patients are awake for maybe 30 minutes or an hour, and then they're asleep for 4 or 5 hours before they're awake again. Sometimes when patients awake, they are lucid and they completely make sense when they're talking. Sometimes they don't. And what I have suggested, and again, I have no science to back me up, it's the world according to Shelley, I think that the spirit becomes a pendulum. And I think when the body sleeps, the spirit spirit is going to whatever comes next. And when the body wakes and the spirit is back in frame, it might be bringing language from whatever that thing was that it was experiencing, looking at, touching on. Again, never done it myself, don't really know what it looks like or how it feels because I can't research it. But every now and then you'll find in these last days that sometimes the language that comes out of the mouth when that body awakens is just a little bit bizarre. Or they might reference seeing people that are already dead. That's very common and very normal. You will start noticing now that the body is beginning to change. So the skin is almost becoming translucent. Some people say that it's just a god-awful pallor. To me, it's more waxy, and the skin is growing translucent. And we might start finding that body parts are doing funny things. So one might be warm, one might be cold, one might be sweaty, one might be dry. That's very normal. The brain is letting go of its ability to control where blood is flowing inside the body. And so we find gentleness and patience, right? To be allowing the extra sleep, to be allowing very little intake going into that body. When the body is awake, to really be checking in, hey, how are you? Where are you, right, in terms of spirituality? And if they want to talk, great. If they want to tell you about this fabulous dream they had, great. If they say, you know, I'm ready to just go back to sleep, great. That's okay too. And really being watchful. The last thing that I teach my families is in this stage of life, the most sensitive marker of human distress is the forehead right between the eyebrows. So I can be having a body doing funky twitching, or one foot's purple and one foot's red, or one hand's warm and one hand's cold, or they're doing kind of the hoochie-coochie in their bed. But this is all calm. And as long as the forehead is calm, I don't care what their body's doing. Forehead is the most sensitive marker of distress. Now, you might find that during sleep, that face is moving, almost like it's engaged in communication or conversation. It probably is. I don't know, because it's a realm that I can't touch. But as long as it's not a grimace that's holding, it's fine. The grimace that holds is the one that I want to medicate. That's when I have my good stuff. Yeah. The grimacing? You know, it's one of the most basic instincts, even in infants, and I don't understand the neuroanatomy of it, but that's where I see it. So if they're uncomfortable, that's where it's going to be. And I've had patients where I had a Huntington's patient, and so his body was doing all these wild things, but this was completely calm and smooth. So that's what I treat too, is the forehead. The last hours, usually there is coma, and so the patient is no longer waking, they are sleeping. Sometimes we hear a rattle or a snore, and that actually is just the shutting down of the lungs, and we can't control the airway the way we used to, and so we hear air bumping over the mucus. So then also in those last hours, you're going to start watching the breathing change pattern. And so we're going to start seeing pauses. And I have family members that are sitting vigil, and they just panic at every pause in the breathing. And so they'll be breathing along, and then they stop. And then they go, and then they breathe along, and then they stop. And so I've had to coach families, just don't panic at that. That's actually a normal pattern. Most patients do not die in that pattern. So I see that pattern in the last 24 to 48 hours before death. And then usually somewhere in the last 12 hours, the pattern reverses back to a regular breathing that's very shallow. And I find that that's when death occurs, is in that last very regular period. You may see right at the moment of death some panting or some very heavy breathing. We don't know why this happens. There's been some hospice literature suggesting that the spirit is birthing into heaven, and so there's a labor associated with birth of the spirit, like you see labor associated with birthing of a baby. Can't study it. Don't really know. But you just see it, and I don't worry about it. If the patient's grimacing and short of breath, I give medication. The skin will be very white now at this point around the mouth and the nose. In particular, you might see nails being actually blue. So we encourage our families to be okay with the sleep. Things that are wet, you dry. Things that are cold, you warm. It's nothing I do is rocket science. I'm very simple about how I manage my dying patients. And what I teach families is I want the forehead cool and calm. I want them cool and calm. And then I'm happy. If they're freaking out or the forehead's freaking out, then we got to get things back under control. You know the death has occurred when you don't see the chest rising anymore. Some family members will put their ear to the chest or actually try and feel for a pulse. They won't feel the pulse anymore. And it's interesting to me that most of my families absolutely recognize death. It's not subtle. It's pretty darn obvious. Everything that they show in movies and television shows where somebody's like agonal breathing and then they grab your lapel to whisper something, that's crap. It doesn't happen. It just doesn't. Death is not scary. These natural deaths actually are quite beautiful to witness and bear witness to. And I do a lot of teaching of my hospital nurses that if they are in the room at that moment of death, it's because the spirit trusted them. And that's okay for them to be in the room and not be feeling like they caused the death somehow. And I think that that spirit chooses that moment of the last breath and knows when it's going to occur, knowing where everybody else is around them. What I teach my students about what a dead body looks like is I ask them to picture their house at nighttime with all the lights on and then begin in their mind turning the lights off of their house. This body is a house, in my opinion. It's housing spirit. And when the spirit leaves, the house is the same. It just looks different because the light has turned off.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is Dr. Shelley Garoni, specialist in hospice and palliative care for Kaiser Permanente, speaking on what happens to human bodies nearing death and whether there are things we can know in terms of preventing such suffering. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
There's been a lot of question about, you know, when does the brain actually turn itself off? And I've always wondered, so when I was in med school and they were talking about sudden cardiac death and the professor said, well, you know, you get VTAC and then you fall over and you're dead. And my question to him was, how does the little toe know that the heart has stopped? Right? Because it would take a while for the be lack of oxygen and gas exchange. So how would it know? And again, we can't really study it, right? Unless you have a death in an active PET scan or MRI scan or something to really understand. My experience is that, and again, I have to go more to the spiritual side, really just feeling that presence leave, feeling everything stop. And I've watched in my ICUs, I had a patient recently that we took off of life support, and I could tell he was gone, but there were still one or two more little heartbeats on the monitor out there after the moment that we could see that he was gone. So I think that the electrical activity probably is doing things in there. We just don't really know how to even study it or reach it. And I don't know how to make it relevant. So we know that there's a heart rhythm that is fatal called pulseless electrical activity. So we can see a rhythm if we put electrodes on the patient's chest, but there's no blood pumping. The gentleman that I was referring to, that we pulled him off life support and he had a couple little more electrical activity things on his monitor, even though I knew he was gone. What was interesting is I let the electrical activity stop. So it was another 10 seconds and I let that stop. And I said to the family, because they were there, I said, he's done. And his children looked up and his son looked at me and he said, oh my God. I was holding his hand. I knew that you had taken the machines off. I knew we were watching things stop. And he said, I had this movie running in my head, and it was so fast that I couldn't catch it, but it was pictures. And it was pictures of me with my dad and at my whole life. So when I was a baby, and then I was a little kid, and then I was a young, bigger kid, and then I was a young man, and then I was an adult. And then he says, as soon as you said it's done, the movie stopped. I don't know. I have no idea how that happened, right? But it's interesting that when you can prepare for the death and be present to the death, actually some really fascinating things happen. Now, delirium is a hard way to have a patient die, and I find that delirium comes, so I have folks that are struggling emotionally or spiritually with their death, we might see delirium. Dementia is very common to cause delirium. And delirium is picking or screaming or crying out. I had a demented elder dying years ago, and she kept screaming about the river. And so, you know, the river. So I called her daughter and I said, did something happen to her in her lifetime around a river? And the daughter said, oh my God, yeah, when she was six, she lived in a really small town and the river flooded and wiped out houses and a couple of her friends. And I said, oh, okay, well, that explains it. And the daughter says, why? I said, oh, well, she's screaming about the river in there. And so if there's a delirium, I treat the delirium. I quiet that. To me, it's like the old LPs, right? When you'd get a scratch on the LP and you'd hear the same thing playing over and over again. So I can get you over the scratch in the LP. I just treat the delirium and quiet that down and let the spirit get back to doing the work that it needs to do. Delirium to me feels like the spirit just gets stuck. And I think we see this in dementia. Again, I have no science for this, but in the demented brain, right, I have forgotten all of these things. And so as the spirit begins to do life review, I think the demented brain is sitting there going, no kidding, we did that. No kidding, we did that. Really, we did that? No kidding, we did that. So it just takes a lot longer to get through that life review work. And the chorea patient that I mentioned, the Huntington's patient, you know, we had to sedate him pretty heavily just to stop him from hurting himself because he was swinging so hard he could hit the sides of the bed. And he wasn't trying to. He was completely unconscious. But that was hard for his mom to watch. I think, honestly, I can treat pain and air hunger really well. I don't have any concern about those. But our own unsteadiness, our own unease, our own discomfort will make the death much more chaotic. I had a patient dying years ago. She was a young woman in her 40s. Her husband would not leave the bedside. Period. Wouldn't go. They had children who were 10 and 12. He wouldn't let them leave the bedside. Now we're on the third day. Now we're on the fourth day. Now we're pushing into the fifth day. And at the end of the third day, I told him, you have to let these children out of this hospital room. I mean, it's a hospital room. It'll drive anybody crazy, right? But these are kids. They've got to get outside and run around. By the fourth day, he was going a little bit crazy. And I'm like, dude, you got to get out of this hospital room. By the fifth day, I went into him and I brought a towel. And he looked at me and goes, what the hell's that for? I said, you stink, man. You got to take a shower. So either go home and take the shower, which is my advice, or get into this bathroom here and take a shower. But you got to stop this. And so that kind of discomfort, I completely appreciate where families are coming from, and I may be like that someday, but we do have to find the ability to help the caregivers take a break and get out. Air hunger is also called shortness of breath. So it's interesting. The studies would suggest almost 70% of dying patients will experience or look like they are short of breath. So we treat it. Opiates. So we actually use the opiates. There are pain receptors or mu receptors in the panic center of the brain as well as in the lungs. So if I bind those, I can open the bronchial tubes and open the blood vessels in the lungs to get better efficiency, but more importantly, turn the panic center off. So that's why we use morphine in hospice. And I've had lots of family members worry that they killed their loved one by giving them morphine. And that's why I teach to, you know, teach to the forehead, treat to the comfort of the forehead, and then you don't need to give any more, right? They're comfortable at that point. So the timing of death is completely out of my control. And I tell families and patients that all the time. You will live exactly as long as you are destined to live. I have zero say in that. I have watched unintentional overdoses happen and people do not die. So I have had to come to the realization that I have nothing to do with the time of death. And I've watched enough deaths to realize that there is something that the dying person chooses. I came in years ago. I had a patient that was living with terrible emphysema. And he looked awful, and I kind of thought he might die that hospitalization. I went into the hospital at 7 in the morning, and he was agonal. He was breathing 4 times a minute. It was clear he was going to die. I called his wife. I got her in. She called her children, got them home from the Bay Area to Sacramento. So now it's 6 o'clock at night. And I go in to see how they're doing, and as I walked in, her sister called her into the hospital room and said, we're here at your house, and we'll be here when you get home. And he died during that phone call. He needed that family to be there and ready for him, ready for her, so that he could feel comfortable to take his leave. So that timing, that last breath, we are completely not in charge of that. And when I have families sitting vigil, I warn them, we're not in charge of that. So your loved one may not want you seeing this last breath. I need you to get up and go pee. I need you to go eat something. I need you to stay hydrated. I need you to not go crazy staring at these four walls. I need you to take breaks. And if they die during that time, they chose that. They chose that moment because they didn't want you remembering the last breath as that final memory. Yes.
I don't mean to shock anybody, but I'd like to kind of be in charge. Like, if you have Parkinson's, as I understand it, you can have it for 10 years.
Easy.
So California, God love them, the last 6 months of this miserable life, they will let you... That's not good enough. Is there any way, if I had that, that anybody would on the down low?
So, you know, it's an interesting question. There's actually a physician somewhere in the East Bay, I believe, who's done a lot of work with the End of Life Option Act. He's taking on a lot of patients privately. I suspect that he's blurring the lines of how the law was written. Don't remember. It will have to come back to me. And there's a lot of people who have that sense of control. I want to be the one that says how these things go. Now, right.
You know.
Right. And so the question that has always struggled with is even with the end of life option. I give you medication that is intended to end your life. We tell our patients we expect death within 30 minutes. And I've had patients live 40 hours. So, and they ingested correctly. They did everything they were supposed to do. So I have to think that there's some power bigger than us, which for those of us who are a little bit type A is not terribly comforting. Now, when you have a loved one who's dying, and I often hear family members saying, I can't get there, or I can't get someone here, or there's an estranged family member who's not going to come, what I suggest is the estranged family members always need to be told someone is dying. They need to be offered the opportunity to grieve and to say goodbye. If they can't make it, or they don't want to make it, or we just have family that can't come, or we have young children and it might be a little bit freaky, I always advise my young parents, ask your children. Would it scare you? And have an exit plan ready to go. If they say, no, I want to see grandma, and then they get in and freak out, right? Have a rapid exit plan to get them back out. But cards, pictures, phone calls, and now FaceTime, all of those are very easy ways to connect with a dying person. And we don't know, again, there's no study about this. So we think the ears are the last things to turn off, and I only think that because I've watched people do crazy things when it seems like they weren't listening. So whisper in their ear, talk to them. It's okay, even if the person is asleep, to have some kind of conversation. And what I'm telling family is this is your time to tell them everything you never said. So maybe this is your dad, and when you were six, he gave you a Tonka truck, and you really wanted a G.I. Joe doll, and you were just pissed off about the whole thing. It feels so stupid, but if it's something that holds you, you should say it and get rid of it. This is the time to say, I'm sorry. This is the time to say, I forgive you. This is the time to say, thank you. This is the time to say that what I will love most about you is going to live on in this way. This is the time to help that spirit finish everything they came to do. And so it's sacred time, and you make every attempt to have the conversations. So I'd like to finish the stories. We started our story with Bill. Bill was 86. He had Parkinson's disease. He had come in very end stage with his Parkinson's disease. He was demented. He was not swallowing correctly anymore. He could no longer walk or talk. He came in with pneumonia. He was in my ICU, really not responding to therapy. And then we contrasted him with Joe. Joe was 68. He had two synchronous cancers. One of them finally metastasized to his spine. He became paraplegic during his hospitalization with me, and his family was afraid of taking away hope. So I was with the night doc, and Bill's family was so upset that they needed to know that Bill knew he was dying. They wanted him told that he was dying, but they didn't want to tell him themselves. It felt kind of freaky. So the nurses called me and said, hey, you're the doc of the house. It's 10 o'clock at night. Can you come talk to Bill and tell Bill that he's dying? And so I had some time, and I went down to the ICU and walked in, and Bill's family is there, appropriately distraught. And they said, we just don't think he knows that he's dying. So can you tell him? And so I looked at Bill, and Bill is laying, and he can't move his body anymore, but he's staring. His eyes are open, and he's staring at the ceiling. And you can see that he is just in awe of whatever it is he can see. His eyes are moving. He's got a smile. He's just completely enthralled with what he can see. And I went up to him, and I introduced myself, and I said, Bill, can you tell me what you're seeing? And he got this amazing big smile, and he goes, angels! And they're beautiful. And I looked at his family and I said, he knows. We're good. Nothing more needs to be said here. Let's just let him hang with the angels. And he died a couple of hours later, closed his eyes again and died in his sleep, and they all did fine. Now we contrast Bill to Joe. Joe was a cantankerous old man. Joe used lots of bad words, so you're going to forgive me when I mimic Joe. Joe had come in with these two synchronous cancers. He was just meaner than a junkyard dog. He really was. But he had this gigantic family and very supportive and very nice people. And I've been taking care of Joe all week. He's gone into this paraplegia. I'm like, holy crap, that's bad, right? So we're trying to have conversations about things are not going well, Joe. And then he goes out on me. He's unconscious. Just, I'm like, oh, great. Well, I don't know what happened here. So I move him into my ICU, and I'm working with the family, and I'm trying to figure out why he's unconscious, and I'm checking calcium, and I'm scanning his head, and he's just out. And so, we get 2 days into his unconsciousness, and I'm meeting with his family in a conference room outside of the ICU, and it's huge. There's 14 people crammed into this conference room, and son number one is spokesperson. And so I said, look, I got to get us on a page. Two synchronous cancers. One is metastasized to his spine. Now I got no brain. This man is dying. And whether he's dying in 3 days or 3 months, he's dying. And we have to come together and get on a page about that and start understanding your wishes and your goals for him. And his son looked at me and he said, you know, Doc, I would take that from you. And I'd be okay, frankly, if he knew that he was dying. So can you wake him up and tell him? My mother-in-law always used to say that I'm a physician, not a magician. No, I can't. And I said, you know, I didn't take him down, so I don't know how to break him up because I don't have any drugs on board. I checked all his chemicals that could possibly take him down. He's just down. But ears are on. Studies suggest that ears are the last thing to turn off. Go talk to him. Go tell him what you need him to know. Go ask your questions. I don't understand how it works, but you're going to get answers if you go ask your questions. And so they looked at me like I was a Martian and this very weird person and kind of went out of the room. And I went and saw a few other patients, and then I came back. And as I'm walking into the ICU, his daughter comes running. Dr. Garoni, Dr. Garoni, you got to come really quick. I'm like, oh my God, what did he do, right? And so I walk in, and Joe's awake. Wide awake. And so they're all gathered around the bed, and I'm at the foot of the bed, and his son's up next to his head and talking to his ear. He goes, Dad, do you know how sick you are? And Joe scanned that whole bed, and he used bad language, scanned that whole bed. He looked at me, looked back at his son, and he goes, where the f*** have you been? Have you not been listening to her? And now I'm standing at the foot of the bed like, I didn't take him down. I didn't wake him up. I haven't been whispering things to him. I did nothing, right? I've just been the doc that's been trying to get this patient comfortable and this family on board. Joe lived another 3 days and he died in our hospital. But his family was able to get those questions answered and get that concern expressed. And that's been the biggest reward for me in taking care of dying patients is you can fix lots of things that feel broken in relationships. You can fix lots of things that feel hurt in ourselves. And even though death is sad and the survivors really struggle, they can find some peace. And that's where I take my work is, can I help you find any peace through this thing that you're going on? Thank you so much.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was Dr. Shelley Garoni, specialist in hospice and palliative care for Kaiser Permanente, speaking on what happens to human bodies nearing death and whether there are things we can know in terms of preventing such suffering. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Alex Espalet, Dan Folds, Carly Mari, and Aiden Nelson. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Tina Pimentuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.